As always, let us reflect on the fact that it is because of the unequal one, the unparalleled one, the infinitely compassionate Samma Sambuddha that we have this Dhamma today. Therefore, let us pay homage to the Lord Buddha, whose infinite compassion, whose infinite kindness and selflessness is the reason we have the Dhamma, his teaching, his doctrine today, to help us all seek salvation, to help us all unentangle ourselves from the shackles of samsara. So let us pay homage to the Lord Buddha before we commence. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Let us also take a moment to invite all those beings that we may have come across in samsara, anyone that might have helped us get to where we are today, because it is only right that we always look back and be grateful to all those people and other beings who have helped us. We do that in normal and day-to-day lives because it is the right thing to do, and therefore we should do this when we and before we commence a sermon as well. There are countless beings that we've come across in samsara, those who might have helped us. It could be something as simple as offering us a glass of water, or perhaps showing us the way when we were lost. And so, let us invite them all, no matter what form they may be today, devas, brahmas, spirits and demons, those beings who are our relations, our relatives, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, uncles and aunts and cousins, literally anyone who we may have come across in samsara, who we may have any form of connection to, as well as anyone who rejoices in meritorious deeds, anyone who rejoices in a Dhamma sermon, in at least looking at someone listening to a Dhamma sermon and rejoicing in that fact, and most importantly, anyone that is looking to listen to these sermons to achieve the noble attainments of Sotapanna, Sakudagami, Anagami and Arahat. So, before we commence, let us invite all those beings. May they all join us. May they all find the opportunity to join us and listen to these sermons in the hope that they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So as I make this invitation, please join me in extending this invitation in your hearts and in your minds out as far as you can to invite all those beings. May they all join us and listen to this sermon. Samanta chakvalesu atanta gacchantu devata saddhamman munirajasansa sunantu sagamokkadam dhamma savana kalo ayam badanta dhamma savana kalo ayam badanta dhamma savana kalo ayam badanta. And finally, before we commence, let us take a brief moment to remind ourselves and accept the fact that in our journey in samsara, in this extremely long journey in samsara, we have not always had the Dhamma. Oftentimes we'll have associated with ignoble people, immoral people, who would have taught us and who would have guided us to pick the wrong thing from the right, And therefore, in not having been able to identify with noble people, Aryas, we may have insulted them, we may have hurt them, we may have harmed them, slandered them, abused them. And in doing so, released energy into this universe, bad karmas that we would have done that now come and hinder our progress in samsara, or hinder our progress as we try to remove ourselves from samsara in listening to the Dhamma. So let us take a moment to accept the fact that yes, we will most certainly have done those things, and yet today, as we have had the association of moral and noble people, the Aryas, today I understand the Dhamma, today I realize that what I did was wrong, and so I seek your forgiveness. May the noble Aryas forgive me. May any Samma Sambuddhas, Paccheka Buddhas, Arahata Buddhas, Anagamis, Sotapannas, Sakurdagamis, that I might have insulted, forgive me for those Aryapavadas. And finally, I would encourage you all to make a firm determination that during the course of this sermon, may you all be able to attain and achieve the noble attainments of Sotapanna, Sakurdagami, Anagami, and Arihat. Okay. So, I often think about the sermons that we do on a Sunday, over the course of the week that comes after the Sunday. And I, as you know, don't always have an audience in front of me. This is quite a interesting experience for me, because normally when we have these sermons in Sinhala, or when I preach to an audience in Sinhala, then there's usually a large gathering. And therefore, when I deliver these sermons, I can gauge how people respond to the Dhamma. I can gauge their understanding, because you can almost see it in their eyes. You'll probably have experienced similar. When you give a talk to an audience, you can almost certainly tell how much of what you're saying is being picked up by people. And if people are beginning to fall asleep, then you know you probably need to either change your tone or perhaps do something to excite the audience and wake them up. But of course, this experience is somewhat different. On some days we do have a small gathering, but usually, in fact, previously, back when we first started these sermons, I have my laptop and the laptop that I use that belongs to the monastery, and I look at a computer screen and deliver these sermons, which is quite an interesting experience, and I have nothing against that. I have absolutely no problem with that. Perfectly fine with that. The only thing I'm sometimes conscious and concerned about is whether our listeners, as in you all, are able to understand what we say. Are you able to make sense of what it is that we're talking about? Because sometimes, yes, you do post questions, but other times I will have to take that no questions is good, because it means you've understood all of it. But this is why I always remind you all, if you have any questions, then please feel free to post them. There will perhaps one day be an opportunity for us all to sit down and sit down face to face, and we can go through various aspects of the Dhamma, go down various avenues. Of course, always focused on Nibbana, because otherwise there's, in my personal opinion, not much point in talking about various avenues of Dhamma if they don't all lead to Nibbana. And so we may one day have that opportunity, but until such time, then please do let me know how you're finding these sermons, and if there's anything that you're looking for, or if there's anything that we need to do in terms of making these sermons more accessible, then again, please do let us know, and we will do what we can to help you there. So I mentioned that I'm always looking for, I'm always trying to focus these sermons on Nibbana. And I hope you've been able to pick up on that, because otherwise I would personally think that I have failed. The reason I say that is I am probably, out of all of us, the most unsure and uncertain about life and when my last moment alive is going to be. Because this is the reality that I face. I face every day. Every morning I wake up and think to myself, is today going to be that last day? In fact, no, I just tell myself, this is the last day that I'm going to be alive. And then I ask myself, how are you going to live the next 24 hours? Do you guys do that? Do you ask yourselves, how do you want to live the next 24 hours if that's the last 24 hours you're going to be alive? In the past, yes, we know, if you have been listening to these sermons, you'll know we've talked about death quite often, because, let's be honest, that is the reality that we all have to face one day. And the reason we're doing all of this is to stop that process of rebirth and death. Dying is not fun. But the thing is, we've all got to face it. Now that we're all born, we don't really have a choice there. And so we have to face that eventuality. That's the reality of living. The reality of living is that living has to come to an end. So I always make it a point to, whenever I study the Dhamma, and I do that very often, and I do that because, well, of course I have time on my hands, time that I didn't have as a layperson. As a layperson, I dedicated my lives to serving the needs and wants of others. In a very material sense. Of course, this sermon right now serves the needs and wants of others. That is the honest truth. But it is me doing something that also serves my wants and my needs. What do I mean by that? Well, if you think about it, if you have jobs, or you're planning on doing a job one day, or say perhaps you're at school right now, or you're still going through education, then the purpose of going through all that is to one day find yourself a job and earn a living. And yet to do that, you expend your time and your energy on serving the needs and wants of other people, your employer. And yet, sometimes the things that you do aren't necessarily things that you enjoy doing. But you're alive, therefore you've got to make a living, and therefore you have to do the things that puts bread on your table, that puts a roof over your head, that puts clothes around your body and gets you medicine when you're sick. The resources that help you send your kids to school. All these things that we have to do because we're alive, and to earn ourselves the means and the resources to do that, we go and serve someone else's wants and needs. It's quite funny, because actually if you think about it, when we go do a job, what we are actually doing is helping someone else out, or doing something that another guy does not like to do, does not want to do. He doesn't want to do it, she doesn't want to do it, and therefore he pays me money, she pays me money, gives me a salary and says, why don't you do it instead, because I don't really fancy doing that. And I am happily willing to accept that, and therefore I dedicate my life to doing the things that someone else does not like doing. Don't you feel like there's something fundamentally wrong with that? Is that the purpose of life? And often we keep coming back to this point. What is the purpose of life? Because for me, it's about being happiness. I always talk about happiness. And happiness is always going to be my number one point of discussion. Because if the things we do don't lead us to happiness, if our ventures and our exercise does not lead us to happiness, then there's something wrong. Oftentimes we've talked about in the past, what is the purpose of our lives? The purpose of my life is to be happy. And that is why I spent a lifetime trying to be happy, did all those things that we've talked about in the past, and then discovered those things weren't really the things that were that was making me happy. And as soon as I realized that, as soon as I realized this is all but a delusion, it didn't take me long to renunciate all of that and find true happiness in life. And therefore, the reason I'm talking to you about this every day, and I'm sure I think, you know, in every sermon that we have, there's probably one word that I keep mentioning time and time again, and that is happiness. Because if you can't find happiness in doing the things that you do, then stop, take a moment, reflect on it before you just keep toiling away. Before you just continue doing the same thing every day, every moment you're awake, every day you're alive until the moment you die. Because guess what? Everyone's been doing that. Your parents have been doing that. Your grandparents have been doing that. You know, your ancestors, all they did was continue doing the things that they thought was what was going to make them happy. But none of them were really happy. And you know that this is the case. I have often asked you to go and speak to your parents, speak to your relations, speak to your uncles and aunts and your cousins and your grandparents, people who've experienced life. Go ask them, are you happy today? Because chances are they'll all have done whatever it is that you're planning on doing at some point in the future. Whether it's starting up a business, whether it's finding yourself a job in a nice fancy office, whatever it is that you're planning on doing, well, guess what? Someone's already done it. Someone's already done it to try and be happy. So go find these people and ask them, is what you're doing making you happy? There was a time when I wanted to be a doctor. And this was around the time when I first went to the UK, and I was kind of figuring out what kind of future do I want to live. I didn't know anything about the Dhamma, except what perhaps I had learned at Dhamma school and in school. So I didn't know any of this, any of the Dhamma that we talk about today. And then what actually put me off from becoming a doctor more than anything was I investigated the lives of the people that had become doctors, people that spent a lifetime, people that had spent sleepless nights, people that had spent a lot of money, in fact, sometimes traveling to other countries, seeking better, looking for more, better and alternative education systems, ultimately to try and achieve this ambition that they had in their minds of, I want to be a doctor, this is what I want. And then, you know, they spend 5-6 years trying to qualify, and once you go through the process and you come out as a doctor, then there's even more training after that if you want to specialize in any kind of field, whether it's dentistry or whether it's, someone wants to be a brain surgeon, another guy wants to be a heart surgeon. Whatever field you want to go down, whatever avenue you want to go down, then you go and spend more time studying all of these things. And then finally, you come out of the system with your MBBS and whatever other qualifications you need to go and actually do the specialization you want. And then what do you do after that? You leave home early in the morning, go into a clinic or go into the hospital or wherever you can meet your clients, your patients, your customers. And then one after the other, you sit down and you go through them. One after the other, go through that process. Next, you know, what do you want? What's wrong with you? And you just keep going through that process. So, and I've got nothing against doctors. If that's what you want, by all means, go and do that. But this is what I realized. People chase these ambitions that they have in life, but you go and then speak to someone and ask, hey, how much time do you actually spend with your family? Why do you do all these things? Well, it's because I can spend time with my family and I've got the money and I've got a nice house and I've got a good car. And, you know, they talk about all the good things that they have. So how much time do you actually spend with the nice house that you have, spending the nice house you have and spend driving the nice car you have and spend with the kids that you have? Not a lot is the answer that usually comes out. And that's actually from a very mundane, from a very worldly perspective. So when you think about that, I've been thinking about actually how do people actually be happy? Because it is becoming more and more obvious to me that the happiness that people look for in life is very subjective. It's not an objective thing. It's a very, very subjective thing. What do I mean by that? One guy does one thing to be happy. Another guy does something entirely different to be happy. So, therefore, it's very subjective. It depends on who you ask. So you couldn't make a broad assumption about anything, any individual, any occurrence that you can see, hear, taste, smell, touch, etc., that, you know, X makes everyone happy. That is entirely untrue. Because it depends on what is it that people like. And you'll know from your own experiences, there's one thing you like one day and then the next day, well, you don't quite fancy that. Or there's one thing that you liked, you didn't like at some point in life. You know, think about certain foods. You know, when you were a kid and your mother wanted to feed you, you know, greens, okay? That's usually a good example. Broccoli. Which kid likes to eat broccoli? But as you grow up, you begin to understand that, you know, these are things that you need. These are, you know, it's got all these nutrients. None of those things made any sense when you were a kid. Well, certainly didn't make sense to me when I was a kid. It was just stuff that my mom wanted to shove through my mouth, and I had no idea how that made her so happy. And for her happiness, I had to sacrifice mine. That didn't seem like a fair world to me. But then, of course, you know, people grow up and kids grow up, and then you begin to understand that these foods that, the greens that your parents have been forcing you to eat are nutritious, and therefore you have to consume them. And the same food that I didn't enjoy, that didn't make me happy, now makes me happy. And I go seeking them, I go after them. In fact, I buy them and feed my kids. So, you know, if one might say that my kids are my most precious, my most precious possession, then if parents are trying to feed their kids broccoli, then surely, that must be a good thing. So, it's very subjective. We keep moving the goalpost. And by moving the goalpost, we decide whether we're happy or we're unhappy. And that just seems to me like a very, very subjective and a very unreal way of truly being happy. So this is why the only true happiness that there is, that anyone can experience, is the happiness in letting go. Because that is ultimate, that is absolute. It's not subjective, it is purely objective. The more you let go, the more happy you are, because you don't have the dukkha dukkha, the viparinama dukkha, and the sankhara dukkha that you have to experience, that you have to go through, that you have to undergo to maintain that level of happiness with subjective things. Now, I use this intro because there was a great question that came through on Skype, I think. It was talking about removing miccha ditti and how that helps us walk the path to becoming a sotapan, I think, and how that helps us, and what is it that we need to do to remove miccha ditti. What is miccha ditti? Isn't it the, you know, let's always keep it simple. I'm a great advocate of two things. One, be happy, and two, keep it simple. Because if you're not being happy, you're not doing the right things, you're not serving the purpose of your life, and if you're making it overly complicated, if you're making it really complex, then guess what? That's not going to make you happy. Because happiness should be something that's simple. Because the more complicated it is, the more things that start breaking, the more things that you have to keep putting together, and the more things that other people will have a vested interest in. This is why letting go is really simple. There are no moving parts in letting go. There are absolutely no parts in letting go at all. It's just letting go of whatever it is you're holding on to, and that process itself makes you happy. So this is why, you know, letting go is the number one way to be happy. But don't take my word for it. You should only accept what makes sense to you. Okay? So Michchaditti. Michchaditti is the what is Michchaditti? That is wrong view, is the direct translation of that. But it's also the opposite of Sammaditti. Sammaditti, as we might have discussed in the past, I don't know if you recall, Samma has an etymology. Etymology is how words are formed. It's a science that is used in English, and if you just Google etymology, and it'll come up with how words are formed in the English language. Even in, you know, if you just type define and colon whatever word you want into Google, what you'll usually get is the meaning of the word and how that word is formed. So that is the etymology, how a certain word is formed. Now, in singular, we call this pada nirukti. Pada meaning a word and nirukti meaning the etymology. How did that word come into being? What are the parts in that word that have certain meaning? So samma has a meaning. Sang is avidya and trushna. What does that mean? Avidya being ignorance and trushna being attachment. And the combination of attachment and ignorance is sang. As a simple example, we talk about sansara. Now, when we use these terms, I'll have to keep jumping back to giving these translations in Sinhala and giving you the etymology in Sinhala or Pali, because these are not English terms. So I hope you can keep up with what it is we're saying. And if you have any, if that doesn't make sense, then please let me know. But I'll try and make it as simple as possible. Because why? Well, that is what I'm an advocate of. Keep it simple. So, sangma. Ma is to distance oneself from something, to remove something, to keep away, to discard. That is ma. The meaning of ma, as in ma, is how you pronounce it, and samma is samma, is how you will probably see sammaditti. This is one of those parts of the Noble Eightfold Path, which I think we talked about in last week's sermon. So sangma is how do you discard, how do you remove, how do you get rid of ignorance and attachment. Sangma ditti. Ditti is view. It's how you look at something. And this is, what is this something we're talking about? How do you look at Dhamma? How do you look at yourselves? How do you look at life and yourselves? So if we come to the understanding that happiness is in letting go, and if you're ready to accept that, not because I'm saying it, but because it makes sense to you. How is that? Well, we've talked about this in the past, how every single item, every little thing you attach to, every person, every occurrence you attach yourselves to bring you dukkha dukkha, sankhara dukkha, and viparinama dukkha, then I encourage you to go back and listen to those sermons. We have discussed this in the past. So I'm not necessarily going to go over that today. But every time we attach ourselves to anything, absolutely, then that is the source of three kinds of suffering. So the more I attach to them, the more suffering I bring towards me. And therefore, the more I distance myself from something, the less suffering it brings me. Simple. Isn't that simple? I mean, if that's not simple, I don't know what is. The more that you attach yourself to something that brings with it these three parts, which are dukkha, dukkha, viparinama, dukkha, sankhara, dukkha, and dukkha is suffering, then the more you attach yourself to it, you're attaching yourself to it, the more you bring suffering closer to you. And the more you distance yourself from it, well, the more you're walking away from dukkha. And if that is what we're trying to do, if that is the purpose of our lives, be happy, well, guess what we need to do? Move away from suffering. Isn't that simple? Okay, so Michchaditti or Sammaditti is coming to that understanding. It's coming to the realization that that is how I can attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. It is by discarding my attachment. Now, I'm not talking about physically letting go of things. Remember, an Arahant makes use of all kinds of physical objects, all kind of material things. You know, he's got a robe, he's got an alms bowl, he lives in a monastery, he's probably got some kind of a kutia or a chalet, he's probably got a bed, he's got all the necessities, the basic requisites. So he's got all of that. But he's not attached to it. How? Not physically, I'm talking about mentally. You're physically attached to it, attached in the sense you're making use of these things. You know, an Arahant doesn't say, hey, well, I'm no longer attached to my alms bowl, so, you know, just put some food on my hands and I'm going to eat it on my palm. That is not an Arahant. If someone says, hey, look at me, I'm really simple, I live a very simple life of, I don't have any attachments at all, and I eat my food on my palm, when they've also got an alms bowl, the teaching that the Lord Buddha gave me tells me that that is not an Arahant. Someone else might say that is an Arahant, but that's not the Lord Buddha's definition of one. So I'm not ready to accept that. You may be, but I'm not. So it's about being realistic. It's about being practical. There is nothing more realistic, there is nothing more practical than the Buddha's Dhamma. Okay? So Sammaditti then is to let go, and by... it's to come to the view. It's not even to let go. It's to come to the view, to the understanding, to the perspective that it's letting go that's going to make me happy. Okay. So when you come to Sammaditti, and this doesn't happen all at once. We talked about eating pizza and how that helped. You know how practicing the Noble Eightfold Path is like eating pizza. You bite away at one slice and you continue that on, you eat bits of pizza slices. So again, that was in last week's sermon. I encourage you to listen to it if you haven't had the opportunity to do so. When you begin to travel the journey of, when you begin your journey on the Noble Eightfold Path, then you practice it by developing elements of Sammaditti. You know, say for example, you have 5% Sammaditti, what do you have 95% of? Michaditti. If you have 10% Sammaditti, what do you have 90% of? Of course, Michaditti. And then one day you're going to have 95% of Sammaditti, what do you have 5% of? Michaditti. And then one day you're going to have 100% of Sammaditti, what do you have 0% of? Of course, well, you've got the answer. And when that day comes, that is when you are an Arahant. That is when you have absolutely the right view about all those things that you attached yourselves before that, that you used to create and build this world around you. Again, I'm not talking about the physical world here. We've talked about this in the past. The world that we're talking about is the world that we build in our minds. Okay, talking about building our worlds in our minds, and I'll come back to the question. I'll mention this because it's a thought that came into my mind recently. I remember when I was a layperson, when I was a layman, my wife and I, we like to go to restaurants every now and then, and I remember, like it was today, that, you know, some days, and, you know, you'll all be able to relate to this. Why are we talking about this? Because practicing Buddhism, practicing Buddhist teaching, if it's not practical, it's not going to work. It has to be practical, so therefore we have to use practical examples from our day-to-day lives. Okay? So, when we had this thought, you know, why don't we go out to eat tonight? Let's go to a restaurant. Well, one of the things I'd find myself doing is going online and reading reviews about restaurants. Which restaurant serves the best food? And you generally then come across various ways of describing a restaurant. And, you know, if you've read restaurant reviews, then I'm sure you'll have come across these plenty times. So what are some of the words they use? This restaurant has an excellent ambience. There was a time in my life I was like, what does that even mean? I'm not going to the restaurant to eat ambience. What is that? Is that some kind of dish on a menu? So there was a time like that. And then they say, well, you know, the manager is very friendly. The waiters and waitresses are very attentive. And there's an excellent mood in the restaurant. They play some beautiful music. And they've got, you know, the interior decorations are brilliant. They're outstanding. And, you know, so these are some of the things that people say when they talk about restaurant. And they've got a fine wine list, and there's you know, food that's laid out ever so nicely and ever so delicately on cutlery, and you know, they say it's fine dining, etc., etc., etc. And I'm sat there reading that review and thinking, I'm going to a restaurant because I'm hungry, and that's because I need to put something in my stomach, in my tummy, so I don't feel hunger anymore. And none of these things are about feeding my hunger. Have you never thought about this? You know, an excellent ambience. How does that feed my hunger? Or it's got beautiful music, and there are and the interior deco sets an excellent mood that is perfect for a night out with your best friends and your loved ones. How does that help quench my hunger? I don't get it. So, do you not realize that when people go to a restaurant, you're really, I wouldn't say blanket all people, but most of the time, and this is what's generally marketed. This is how people lure you into a restaurant. They're not necessarily talking about the food, or, you know, the quantity of the food that's being laid out even. Because ultimately, why do we eat? I'd say there's two reasons. Okay, maybe three. One, because you're hungry. Two, because you're going to be hungry. And so you don't want to be hungry in a few hours' time. So if you eat now, then you can get on and do whatever it is you need to do then. And thirdly, you need to get all the nutrients you need into your body so you're not going to fall ill. And you can keep away, you know, all the diseases and have a good immune system, etc., etc., right? So I would say that these three are the main reasons why people ought to be eating. But is that why people actually eat? And so when you go into a restaurant, how often do they say, you know, we've got good portion sizes, and, you know, you can, these foods are gonna fill you up. How many different types of food do you need to put out your hunger? You just need one type of food. Why do you need 10 different types of food? Why do they have 7 course meals and 10 course dinners? And I don't get it. I really don't get it. So you see, all these things are notions that the world, and what do I mean by the world? It's people that live in the world. People that make a life, people that make a living out of your suffering, out of your agony, out of your pain, and out of your vexation. Does that make sense? People that make a living out of your suffering. How does that work? Well, think about it. If you were entirely satisfied with just eating whatever was served on your plate at home, and that could just be one, you know, rice with one curry. Or if you like to eat polsambol, then, you know, polsambol and rice. You know, if you were just happy eating that, and if everyone in the world was just happy eating that, I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, do you get all the nutrients? Okay, right. Let's talk about a nutritious meal, which is a balanced diet. So you have your proteins, you have your vitamins, you have your calcium, and you have all those essential nutrients that you need, all that served on a plate. Okay, if you, and I'm sure, you know, when you normally eat at home, then, you know, you will from time to time have that, maybe not all the time, but you will from time to time have that. And if you could be happy with eating that, and you could just repeatedly eat that every day, why would you need to go to a restaurant? So how restaurants make their money is by giving you this idea that you need a new experience. Restaurants can only make money if you're unhappy. Shop owners can only make money if you're unhappy. Shoe designers, you know, think about it. If you were happy just wearing a pair of flip-flops, okay, and you could wear flip-flops to work, you could wear flip-flops to school, you could wear flip-flops absolutely anywhere and everywhere, then what do you think is going to happen to the designer, shoe designer, you know, designer wear, okay? What's going to happen to them? Well, they're going to be out of a job. Just as much as, let me give you another example. Think about Leisure World. Or if you think about a leisure park, where, you know, as young kids you might go from time to time. If a kid was perfectly happy at home, playing with toys that he might have at home, or playing with his brother or sister, or just, you know, sitting and doing whatever it is that kids do these days at home. Okay? If you are entirely happy with that, then how would the people that operate Leisure World, how would people that operate this entertainment attractions make their money? They wouldn't. They wouldn't be able to make a living. They wouldn't be able to quench their hunger. They wouldn't be able to put a roof over their heads. They wouldn't be able to feed themselves or send their kids to school, and they wouldn't be able to cure themselves if they were ill. Why? Because they need to make money, and they make money because you're suffering. So people in this world make a living because you're suffering. Now, here's the most interesting thing. If that is the case, why do you go after them expecting them to make you happy? Why do you go to Leisure World expecting them to make you happy, when actually, if you were entirely happy, they wouldn't be able to make a living? They'd have to shut down. So do you think they would like for you to be happy? Do you think they'd like you to be really happy? Think about it. Because if you were entirely happy, if you didn't need anything else to be happy, and you were self-sufficient, you had everything you need to be happy right with you, then they'd have to shut down. So, and yet if you're going there and asking them, and you want them to make you happy, and yet they don't want you to be entirely happy. Why? Because if they do, then they'd have to shut down. Why do you think they would want? Where's their interest in trying to make you happy? Do you not see that there's a conflict of interest here? You know, we need to think about these things, because otherwise we just keep doing what everyone's been doing time and time and over again. So, Michcha Ditti is really, you know, not spending the time, not being able to reflect and not being able to realize that this is the reality of the world that we live in. That is what Michcha Ditti is. Yes, of course it has a meaning that in relation to our journey in samsara, but, you know, even little things like this is why we continue to travel and journey in samsara, because we continue to fool ourselves into thinking that, you know, this world can make me happy. The people outside that serve me, that run these entertainment attractions, that holiday operators, tour operators. Again, you know, another example. Think about tour operators. Again, you know, listen, guys, I've got nothing against these people, and, you know, long may they be able to run their businesses, and long may they be able to make money out of it, and may their businesses be as successful as they can ever imagine, beyond their imaginations. Okay, but that does not change the truth. That does not change the reality one bit. Because if you and I were entirely happy with where we are right now, would we ever need to go on holiday? And therefore, isn't the reason we are going on holiday because we are unhappy, because we are unsatisfied, because we are unfulfilled? And then if I walk up to a tour operator, holiday operator, and ask him, you know, hey, can you make me happy? And if he says, well, of course I can make you happy. I can make you absolutely happy. Why would he want to do that? Because if he was able to give me permanent happiness, then he would have to shut down his business. You see, this is what I want you to think about. Think about this, okay? So that's really one aspect of Mithyaditti. Trying to find happiness in the world and not realizing that the world is not really, you know, it's not in the world's interest to make you happy. That is probably how I could summarize that. It is not in the world's interest to make you happy. And yet where do you go looking for happiness? You go to the world. You go to people that run these businesses. You go to people that operate holiday attractions and all those things. Okay? So, that being the reality, you really need to think about, well, you know, again, going back to that restaurant where we used to read reviews, you know, and then in reading reviews, what I used to do is to fill my mind up with all the things that other people in this world thought about that restaurant. You know, this, as every review I read that tells me that this is such a great restaurant is really from a very super mundane perspective, and I'm not talking about worldly existence here, okay? I'm talking about from a super mundane existence. So we need to take this with wisdom. I'm not talking about our existence in this world and continuing that, because clearly that is not our aim and our objective. How do we go beyond that is what we seek. That's what we're trying to find. Every review I read is really someone telling me why this great restaurant is such a great place, why I should go dine there. Isn't that really association with immoral and ignoble people? In Sinhala, is that not what we call Asat Purusha Sevane? And, you know, you go there, and if you think about the real reason why you go out to eat, or whether you eat at home, you know, well, we've gone one step beyond that. You're now at the restaurant. You've gone beyond, I need to feed my hunger. But in any case, the real reason you're there is to feed your hunger. You're hungry. Your stomach is telling you, I'm in pain. Please help me. You've traveled all that way to not only feed your hunger, but you're feeding your eyes, you're feeding your ears, you're feeding your nose, you're feeding all these other organs which are also in vexation, but that's not real. What do I mean by that? It's only physical pain that is actually for real. Does that make sense? It's only physical sensations that are real. So, you know, physical sensations, there are good physical sensations. There are pleasurable physical sensations, and then there are painful or unpleasurable physical sensations. These two things are very real. There's no doubt about that. If someone comes and hits you, that hurts. Whether you're an arahant or you're a prithakjana, that is a worldly, mundane person, you're still going to feel pain. It doesn't matter what your mental state is, you're going to feel that pain. Because that is real. And if you're given a comfortable bed, or someone, say, you know, someone's hit you, or you've knocked yourself on something, and now someone's applying some ointment, and you know, in the process of that application, you know, you're feeling good. That's a pleasurable physical sensation. When your mother used to pat you on the head and said, you're such a good boy, that was a pleasurable physical sensation. If you did that to an arahant, then an arahant is going to feel the same. He's going to feel the pleasurable physical sensation, and he's going to feel the unpleasurable, painful physical sensation. But beyond physical sensation, everything else, what about your eyes? Is that real? I mean, you know, one guy looks at a picture of a really, let's say, of feces. There's a guy that's looking at a picture of feces, and he begins to gripe. You can see it in his face that he's really not enjoying this and he wants to look away. But you force him to look at it. Okay? He's not enjoying that. He finds that unpleasurable. He finds that painful. And then you show him a picture of someone that they like, or a picture of a holiday that they've been on, their favorite holiday. And, you know, they're feeling really happy looking at that picture. Why is there this difference? Is that for real though? What is the eye seeing except for color? As we've talked in the past, the eye is not sensitive to anything else other than light. And what does light bring into your eyes? Color. That is all the eyes are seeing. So everything else that you're actually seeing, that you're actually looking at, is a product of your mind. Your mind is picking up all these visual sensations, as in color, and then it's interpreting what it's looking at by doing all these weird and wonderful things in your mind, which we've talked about, I think, to some extent, which is what we call manasikara. So it's doing that in the mind, and it's producing these images which you either like or you dislike, and that's very subjective. Why is it one guy likes one girl and the other guy does not like the look of that girl? So clearly that is subjective, but both guys, you know, you hit them with a stick, it's going to hurt them. There's no question about that. If you've got a bad tooth, it doesn't matter whether you're an arahant, whether you're black or white, whether you're tall or short, whether you're Asian or Caucasian, that's going to hurt you. There's no question about that. But what the girl you want to get married to looks like, that is very subjective. What kind of house do you like to live in? What does that look like? That's very subjective. What kind of clothes do you like to wear? What color is what's your favorite color? That's very subjective. So you show someone a color that they don't like and they look away, and then you show someone a color that they like and they keep staring at it. That's very subjective. So clearly then, if that is subjective, then that object, whichever object we're talking about, whether it's a person or an incident, or then just take a sunset, whatever the case might be, that object, to keep it simple, you look at, that's not really bringing you any kind of pleasurable or unpleasurable sensation. Where do we create this pleasurable or unpleasurable sensation? We create it in our minds. The same goes for sounds. There are some sounds and there are some songs that people like. There are some songs that people don't like. How is that the case? I mean, some people like rock music, others like classical music. Right? So, how is that the case? Because ultimately, all the ear is picking up is sound. Just raw sound is picking up frequencies. So, it picks up do, it picks up re, it picks up mi, it picks up fa, so, la, ti, do, and, it picks up those frequencies. But it doesn't pick up a song, it doesn't pick up rock music, it doesn't pick up classical music. Rock music and classical music are products of your mind. So when that happens, if there's a guy that likes rock music, he's attached to that. And he says, hey, this rock music, I like listening to this, and therefore I take pleasurable sensation from this rock music. The guy that doesn't like to listen to rock music says, I don't like this, so this doesn't bring me pleasurable feeling. In fact, it brings me unpleasurable feeling. Please, could you switch off that music? Can you turn? Have you not got any classical music? Because I really like listening to that. How is that the case? Because if pleasure existed in the object, it shouldn't matter who's looking at it. It shouldn't matter. I'm talking about sight here now. If pleasure is in the color, is in the sight, then it shouldn't matter who's looking at it. It shouldn't be subjective. It should be objective. The reason it's subjective is because it's a function of our minds. It's a function of raga, dvesha, moha. Aversion, desire, aversion, and delusion. In fact, to keep it really simple, it's a function of delusion. As long as we have that delusion in our minds, there are things that we like, and then there are things that we don't like. So going back to our restaurant, when you went in there, your stomach is telling you that it's hungry, which is very real. Why? Because that's a physical sensation. That's your body telling you that. And so if you're sat there and, you know, as you attempt to sit down, you try to sit on your chair, and all of a sudden you feel a prick on your backside, and you stand up, and you look at your chair, and someone's left a fork there. That's gonna hurt. Doesn't matter who you are, it's gonna hurt. But what does it matter what color the cushion is? But can you think of how much pain and effort the restaurant owner has gone to make sure that all the cushions are the same color, and that it matches the color of the tablecloth, and that it matches the color of the other furniture in the restaurant, and the walls that are painted, and the deco that they have in the restaurant. So what's that feeding? Is that feeding your hunger? No, it's feeding your eyes. But it's not necessarily feeding your eyes, it's actually feeding your mind. That's what it's feeding. And it has got nothing to do about what a restaurant is at all in the first place. But our minds are asking for this. You know, in the last program we talked about these sets of five, Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, right? Where all the mind's doing is taking a set of five, Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, and then discarding it immediately afterwards. Picking up a new set of Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, and then discarding it immediately afterwards. How long does it keep it? For about 1/1,000,000th of a second. That's all the mind is doing. So you're at the restaurant, you're ordering your meal, your favorite meal, you've had your meal, you've looked at the sights, you've looked at the sounds, you've smelled all the smells, you've touched all the things you wanted to touch, okay? And you've tasted all the tastes. I mean, even taste. Ultimately, that is not, you know, there is no pleasurable taste and unpleasurable taste. There's just taste. One guy likes pineapple pizza. The other guy likes cheese and onion pizza. I don't know if there is a pizza, cheese and onion, but hey ho. Okay? A tomato pizza. Okay? So how is it then that one guy likes one whereas the other likes another? Actually, think about this. We've talked about the health to some extent in the past. What do you think suffering in the hells is like? You're probably thinking, why am I talking about the hells all of a sudden? Well, you'll see the connection in one moment. How do they make you suffer in the hells? Do they take you to the hells and then show you pictures that you don't like? Do they make you listen to songs that you don't like? I mean, you like rock songs, and therefore what do? They make you listen to classical music. Is that how they make you suffer in the hells? Or perhaps, do they make you smell, do they make you take in foul smells? Is that how they make you suffer in the hells? Or is what they actually do inflict pain on the body by cutting you up, chopping you up, cutting off your fingers, your limbs? Isn't that how they inflict pain in the hells? By dropping you into a cauldron of fire? Isn't that how they inflict pain in the hells? So do you see that they can only inflict pain on you by inflicting that pain on your physical body? Because, I mean, if you think about it, if they showed you pictures of feces, right? Let's to keep it simple again. Pictures of feces. What is feces? If there are very young listeners listening to this, it's what you go to the toilet and flush and come back. That's feces. That's what comes out of you when you've eaten, when you've taken food. So, you know, if they show you pictures of that, then to stop that suffering, all you would have to do is come to the agreement with your own, in your own mind, accept that, actually, I do quite like looking at pictures of feces. I don't mind that, actually. I quite like looking at pictures of feces. And all of a sudden, you're not suffering. Or perhaps, if in the health, the way they inflict pain on you is by making you listen to classical music when you enjoy rock music, then the only thing you'd have to do is think one morning, or one fine day, just go, hey, actually, classical music isn't all that bad after all. I quite like classical music. That's not bad. And now what happens? Then all that, you know, all that pain is just going to go away, just like that. Because those things are actually, you know, when one guy likes rock music and they're made to listen to classical music, then that pain is only felt in the mind. That frustration is only felt in the mind, and therefore it's not real. It's just a dream. It's like a dream that you wake up from. When you come out of that restaurant, what are you left with? Think about it, really. What are you left with when you come out of that restaurant? You have food in your stomach. That is real. You went in hungry and you've come out not feeling hungry. You've come out full. You're satiated. Okay? You've eaten your stomach full. You've eaten your share. So that is very real. But what about the sights that you saw? Is any of that leftovers? Were you able to pack any of that up? What about the sounds that you heard? Is any of that left? What about the smells that you were able to take in? Do you have any of that left over? So ultimately, you're only coming out with the food that you've eaten and less money in your pocket. Now, again, think about this. If you're coming out with food in your stomach and less money in your pocket, if you were able to do exactly the same thing, which is come out with food in your tummy, but with less money lost in the restaurant. What I mean by that is, let's take an example. You go into restaurant A, which is a really fancy restaurant. Okay, all the bells and whistles, fine dining, and it's got, you know, all that interior decorations, and managers who are only too eager to come and talk to you. I mean, if they could, they'd come and feed you. Then there are the waiters and waitresses who are so attentive that you think they might come and walk you home. Okay, so you've got all that, and for you know, ultimately, when you come out of that restaurant, then all you're left with is food in your stomach, right? There's no question about that. You know, all the sights you saw, all the sounds, all that chit-chat you had, none of that is left. It's all gone. It's like gone in the wind. But you have the food in your stomach. And you went into this fancy restaurant with $1,000. And you come out with $500. So you've spent $500 in that restaurant. Okay, pounds, you go in with £1,000, you come out with £500. Rupees, you go in with 1,000 rupees and you come out with 500 rupees. It doesn't matter what currency you use. It's just take a unit. 1,000 units and you come out with 500 units, and with food in your stomach. Then you go into another restaurant, restaurant B, which is just a usual box standard restaurant. Yes, you have food, it's very clean, it's very healthy. But, you know, the manager minds his own business. The waiters will come and bring you food, or perhaps it's self-service. So they don't really have lots of waiters and waitresses. You got to go and get your own food. And they don't have the bells and whistles. You know, it's just plain colored walls. There's the plain colored tablecloth, plain colored furniture, and there's just, you know, usual kind of day-to-day kind of furniture, and they don't really play any music in the restaurant, what do you come out of that restaurant with? Do you still not come out with food in your stomach, but more money in your pocket than you went in there with? Sorry, not than you have lost in restaurant A. So restaurant A, you went in with 1,000, you came back with 500. Restaurant B, which was just a box standard restaurant, you went in with 1,000, you come back with 800. You've only lost 200. And yet, you've come out the same way that you went into restaurant A. And to earn that 1,000 units of money, well, money don't grow on trees. You had to work hard. You worked hard, you toiled, you exerted your body, you exerted energy. You went places, you had to travel on a bus, you had to go on a train, you had to drive there. Okay, you had to do all that. You had to walk to work, you know, whatever your commute was. And then you had to do what your boss said you had to do. You didn't particularly enjoy doing that. As we said at the beginning, you do this, you know, to make your boss happy, because it's the things that he doesn't like doing, therefore he makes you do it. And he pays you money to do it. Okay? So you've done all these things so that you could go into restaurant A and come out, in fact, worse off than if you went into restaurant B. Why? Because you've got less money in your pocket, but you've come out with exactly the same result. Who do you think is more successful? Who do you think could be happier? Why do we not think about these things? You know, I've used the example of a restaurant. How many other things can you actually relate this to? What about houses? You know, the houses that people build these days, and the houses that people like living in these days, some are almost palaces. I mean, I've seen houses on my travels around the world, you know, that are quite, well, virtually palaces. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 bedrooms. There are two people living in this house, husband and wife. How many bedrooms? 10 bedrooms. How many bedrooms do you think they can sleep in? How many bedrooms can you sleep in one night? 5? So why do you need 5 bedrooms then? But what about all the hard work that you had to do to buy or build a 5-bedroom house? Did you not sacrifice the only thing that was real? You see, it's your body that actually, you know, as we said, the physical sensations are real. So physical painful sensations are real. They're not fake. They're not a dream. You can feel it. If you cut yourself, that's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt you until it heals. But if you see a picture that you don't like, the moment you move your head away, the moment you close your eyes, the moment the picture is taken away, well, you're not looking at that picture anymore. Well, the mind might still be suffering, but that's the mind suffering. It's not your eye suffering. This is why an arahant doesn't suffer when you show them a picture that they don't, you know, I mean, an arahant doesn't have pictures that they like and they don't like. It's just a picture. That's all it is. Okay? So, building that house, building a 10-bedroom house or buying a 10-bed house, that required a lot of energy. That required a lot of effort. Sometimes, you know, people, that is the money that they've earned, you know, all their lifetime. You know, some people take out huge mortgages and they spend a lifetime paying these mortgages. Why? So that they could live in a 10-bedroom house and drive a Mercedes. When actually the requirement is to get from A to B, which you can do in a Maruti. You don't need a Mercedes Benz to do that. And a bed so you could crash for the night. So you could rest your head on. You could rest your body on and just go to sleep. That's all you need. So why do you need a 10-bed house? But what about all the pain that you had to suffer, all the pain that you had to endure to get yourself and maintain and keep that 10-bed house? You see, have you not sacrificed the only thing that was real? Have you not sacrificed that? As in pleasurable physical comfort of not having to exert your body, not having to inflict pain on your body, you know, just sitting down and just relaxing, not having to do anything. Did you not sacrifice that to buy a 10-bedroom house, and yet what you have now is nothing but a dream. I mean, yes, it's a 10-bed house, I get that. But you can only sleep in one bedroom. You can only sleep on one bed. You're not actually satisfying any part of your body by having a 10-bed house. The fact that you have a 10-bed house is nothing but a mental satisfaction. So why don't you just build yourself a hut and then imagine that's a 10-bed house? You'd be happier. You'd be 100 times happier. Just build yourself a mud hut. Get yourself a bed. Sleep on it. And then think to yourself, I live in a 10-bed house. Get into your Maruti. Drive wherever you want to go. You know, drive to work. Get out of your car and get out as if you're getting out of a Mercedes-Benz. Why couldn't you do that? Because it's ultimately just the mind. Because everything else, you know, nothing, it's only the physical sensations that are real. Your eyes, your ears, your nose, as in smell, and your taste. You know, these four organs and these four sensations, whether it's pleasurable or unpleasurable, are purely subjective. And yet, people sacrifice a lot to please the mind by using these organs, by seeking these sensations. Think about, I mean, when I was in the UK, I remember how we would travel to Sri Lanka on holiday. I mean, that was a 13-hour long flight, sometimes 13, 14 hours, and if you had to break the flight, then, you know, you had to transit in somewhere in the Middle East, usually. And yet, you know, that was a very long flight. But why would we travel all this distance? To see things, to hear things, to taste things, to take in new tastes, to take in new smells, a new experience. But what about the pain that I had to endure physically, sitting on that seat for 13 long hours and stuffing myself with the food that they serve on the plane, on a flight? Okay, not able to digest it properly. Okay, feeling bloated because it's full of gas, and then not being able to, you know, and feeling really uncomfortable. Your ears locking out. All that, you know, all that physical pain you actually endured for what? To please your eyes and ears and your nose and your tongue. None of which it was actually real, because the moment you look away, the moment you stop listening, the moment you take that taste away, it's gone. It's just a fantasy. It's just a dream. It's like when you wake up from a dream, you know, what's happened to the dream? You know, when you're, for as long as you're dreaming, you're able to enjoy your dream. Okay? So you're asleep, you're seeing a dream. And it's a nice dream. You know, you're seeing the person that you like, the person that you love in your dream. Okay, you're playing with a toy that you really like. You know, you're riding a bike, the bike that you always wanted your dad to get you. What happens when you wake up? What's happened to all of those things? Gone, never to come back. Aren't we all living a dream? Aren't we all sacrificing real happiness for a dream? Isn't this life but a dream? You see, the other day I was speaking with one of our monks in the monastery, and I was saying, you know how sometimes in prisons, where they the kind of punishment that they give is actually locking people up in a dark room. Okay, so what they do is, if that's the punishment that this crime, that fits the crime, then they take the convict, and they lock them up in a prison cell. But unlike normal prison cells, there's no daylight that comes into this prison, into this cell. In fact, there's no light at all, so they don't have a bulb. So it's absolute darkness. And there are no sounds. So these walls are about several meters thick. And therefore, you can't feel any vibrations, and you can't kind of put your ear to the wall and hear anything. So what are they actually doing then? And actually, the only kind of sensations that you receive is you can feel. Why? Because it's real, okay? You can feel the walls, you can feel yourself. And then whenever it's meal time, again they put some food on a plate, and you can't see what this food is because there's no light. And then you just take whatever plate or dish that it's being served, you eat it, and then that's the end of it. You put the plate back, and then they take it away. You can't talk with anybody. You know, and sometimes this can be days and weeks and even months and maybe years. You know what this does to people? It makes them go crazy. Makes people go mad. There are plenty of these stories where people locked up in dark rooms go mad. If you have access to the internet, just do a quick Google search. Not now, later on. Of how, you know, people that were locked up in these cells went mad. So why does that happen then? The mind is always looking to taking new sensations. The mind's looking for what? You should know this now. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. So the mind's looking for this. And the mind wants to take in Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, the five aggregates from the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, and the body. Well, obviously you can't take away sensations from the body unless you put someone in a coma, or you're gonna have to put someone into a coma, and then that's when they stop feeling sensations on their body. But then you can't kind of give them punishment if you're in a coma, because you don't know what's happening. Okay, so you got to keep them awake, but take away all the sights, take away sounds, take away smells, and take away, well, taste. You get taste when you eat the food. But I think the food that is served is also very bland. It's enough to keep you going. So it's got all the nourishment, it's got all the nutrients, and it's nourishing, but it's very bland food. So there are no different tastes there's no variety in the taste that you can experience. Okay? So this is the kind of pain that they give you. This is the punishment that they inflict on you. Now, when I was talking about this with a monk in the monastery, I was telling them, you know, they better not invite us into this prison to give these people a talk. They better not invite, you know, anyone, any monk or any lay person that understands this Dhamma, the fact that the mind is nothing but a machine, that nothing but the taking in of Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, one set of five, the second set of five, the next set of five, you know, you better not bring anyone that understands that this is all that existence is. There's the body, and there's the mind that's just taking in sets of five. You better not bring one of us to give a sermon at a prison. Why? Because the moment we go into prison, you know, we can only tell them the truth and nothing but the truth. So my sermon to if I were to go and speak at a prison, my sermon to them would be, you know, what you do in a prison and what I do outside is exactly the same. There's nothing different. Why do you think you're locked up in a prison? You know, your mind's doing exactly the same thing, taking in sets of five. You think I'm not in a prison and I'm a free man. What am I doing? Taking sets of five. And also, locked up in that prison, in that dark room, it's only the body that is feeling real sensations. So whether I'm in a dark room or not, I'm feeling bodily sensations. That man, the prisoner locked up in a dark room, is feeling sensations. Now, the things that they see, the things that, well, they obviously they don't see because there's no light in the dark room, That is the form of the punishment. If I had the opportunity to speak to someone like that, I just say, well, whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever you taste, whatever you smell is only a dream. The next moment that that sight or that sound or that taste is or that smell is taken away from you, it's just gone in the wind. So why bother working hard? In fact, aren't you and I working harder than that man in the prison, locked up in a dark room? How come? Because you and I are taking in inputs from our eyes, we're taking in sounds from through our ears, we're taking in taste through our tongue, we're taking in smells through our noses, and we're also obviously taking in physical sensations. Of us, you know, between us and the person stuck in a dark room or imprisoned in a dark room, they're taking in taste when they're being fed, and then they're taking physical sensations because they can feel, they can touch, and they can feel. But three things, sights, sounds, and smells, they're not taking. So the mind does not have to work hard to interpret those signals. We are working harder than them. Thinking about that, I think I feel more imprisoned than the man that's imprisoned in a dark room. I feel that I am stuck in a cage and not the man in a dark room. He's got it better than I have. He's got it better than you and I. He's got it better than we all have. Does he not? Aren't we all really stuck in a cage? In this cage, where the punishment that we have to endure is, we have to take in sights, we have to take in sounds, we have to take tastes and smells, and we have to take the physical sensations. Why? Because our mind is functioning, our bodies are functioning. And as we've discussed in the past, our minds are not able to interpret sights and sounds at the very fundamental level. I mean, when you're looking at a picture, you know, think about a TV screen. If you walk up to a TV screen, you know, you walk really up close, you'll be able to see pixels on it. Or your computer monitor if you're sitting in front of one. If you bring it really close to your eyes, if you move your head quite close, you know, really close to your screen, you'll be able to see that there are pixels. There are red, green, and blue, I think, if I remember right. These pixels. So what the mind is actually receiving, or what your eyes are actually doing, is picking up tiny figments, tiny fractions of these of light, and then sending them through to your through your brain, and making a mental snapshot on your mind. And when your mind takes this mental snapshot, the mind takes one mental snapshot and it tries to interpret what it's looking at. It's not able to interpret it. Therefore, it takes in a second mental snapshot. What is the second mental snapshot? The second bit of light that came through your eyes. And then the third bit of light that came through your eyes. The fourth bit of light that came through your eyes. And then guess what happens then? Well, your ears start hearing something as well. So now your mind has to stop listening, to stop seeing, and now it's got to divert its attention to listening. So now it takes in one bit of sound, the second bit of sound, the third bit of sound, and then all of a sudden you're tasting something, or you're smelling something, and now the mind's got to stop looking, it's got to stop hearing, and now it's got to start smelling. You know, aren't you really stressing your mind out? You know, you're really making it work hard. None of which that guy stuck in a prison has to do. So between that guy and you and us, you and I, who's actually suffering? Who's actually experiencing real pain? Who's being punished? Don't you see that actually it's us that's being punished, not the guy in the prison? See, the only reason that the guy in the prison feels that he's being punished, and why conventionally that we take that it's him that's being punished, is because the mind is looking. The mind is only satisfied when it takes in the five aggregates. and to take in the five aggregates, to produce these five aggregates, it's constantly looking for sights and sounds and smells and tastes and physical sensations. But that's because the mind is restless. That's because the mind is ignorant. That's because the mind is delusioned. And therefore, if that man imprisoned were to understand this Dhamma, if I were able to have one moment with that man and explain to him, "Hey, Mr. Prisoner, you don't realize, do you, that actually you are a free man. You are actually suffering less than all of us outside in the world. What do you think is what is your problem? And you thought you had a problem? What about all the sights that I have to see? Why does an arahant observe Nirodha Samapatti? Think about it. Why does an arahant try to stop the mind that takes in the five aggregates? It's because it's a very taxing, it's a very painful, it's an arduous, you know, you have to do it. You can't stop doing it. This is what you need to understand. So, the pain, therefore, you know, as the point we were discussing is, you know, this pain that is actually real, is the only pain that is real, is a pain that we feel on our physical body. Everything else is very subjective. It's a subjective pain, and it's a subjective pleasure as well. That's the other side of the coin. But it's because you established the two sides of the coin that you now have, the good side and the bad side. You only got heads and tails because you've got the coin in the first place. If you didn't have a coin, you'd have no heads and you'd have no tails. Likewise, if you didn't have an expectation, if you didn't have a desire on anything, then it wouldn't really matter what color the world is. If you didn't have a favorite color, then you wouldn't be sad or you wouldn't be happy or sad because of someone showing you that color. If you didn't have a favorite kind of music, then you wouldn't be happy or sad because of someone either allowing you to listen to that music or not allowing you to listen to that music. If you didn't have a favorite smell, say a perfume, then you wouldn't be happy or sad because of an external factor. You know, remember, the reason we are talking about this is because people live a life expecting that happiness is outside, and therefore they're wanting to experience happiness from the outside world. And in trying to do so, they establish happiness and unhappiness. And the moment you do that, remember, the world is anicca. The world is not to your liking. What you like or dislike, whether you like red or blue, whether you like rock music or classical music, is not a factor that determines what kind of music you're going to hear next. Whether you like red or blue is not a factor that determines what color you're going to be seeing next. What color you're going to be seeing next is dependent on the causes that give rise to the result, the effect. What music you're going to hear next is dependent. It's predetermined. What smells you're going to take in next is predetermined. Sorry, not predetermined, but preconditioned, as we've talked in the past. Nothing's predetermined, it's all preconditioned. What color you're going to see next is preconditioned, because it's conditions that give you the result. What sounds you're going to hear next is preconditioned. What smells you're going to take in next is preconditioned. Well, of course, what physical sensations you're going to take in next is also preconditioned. But whether it's going to be painful or pleasurable is not subjective. It doesn't matter if someone hits me or hits you or hits anyone else that you know, we're all going to feel pain in exactly the same way. So, in trying to attain Nibbana, So, you know, of course, you know, one could ask the question, well, I get it, okay? The sights that I see and when whether that's pleasurable or painful is a function of what I determine to be painful or pleasurable, right? I can determine whether I choose black or white, whether I choose red or blue. Okay, I can make a choice about whether I like rock music or classical music, and I get it. You know, if I like rock music and someone plays classical music, then I don't like it, right? I get all of that. And then you're probably thinking, but you know, if physical pain is real, where do I go? What can I do about that? Well, that is why we talk about Nibbana. That is why we say we have to attain Nibbana. This is why we talk about the Sotapanna Pale, the fruit of Sotapanna. Why? Because if you attain the fruit of Sotapanna, where do you not go after that? The hells. How do they punish you when you go to the hells? They don't show you a picture that you don't like. They don't make you listen to music that you don't like as punishment. They don't make you smell things you don't like as punishment. They don't give you taste that you don't like as punishment. What do? They inflict physical pain on your physical body. That is how they punish you. Take a dog that's in the Tirisan Loke, Tirachane Yone, okay, in the animal hell. When we talk about a dog and we talk about how a dog suffers, how do we, you know, what are some of the examples that we use? You know, think about when a dog's feeling hungry. When dogs get a headache. Don't dogs get headaches? Of course they do. How many times have you taken a pet to the vet and said, hey, what's wrong with this, my pet, you know, it keeps crying every day, you know, from time to time, can you please let me know what's wrong with it? And they examine the animal head to toe and go, there's absolutely nothing, head to tail even. And they go, there's absolutely nothing we can see that's wrong with this animal. So it's feeling something that, you know, you can't observe. Okay, or a vet can't observe. So, you know, animals feel pain. Of course they feel pain. There's no question about that. You know, and then sometimes we talk about how animals have, or a dog has wounds. Wounds that are infested. You know, if you look at stray dogs, and you know, if you live in countries where there are stray dogs, you know, some dogs they don't have any hair on their bodies because they've got some kind of skin infection, or they have festering wounds, and there's pus in those wounds, and there are worms in those wounds, but no one attends to them because they're stray dogs. Do you ever hear people say, well, I saw a dog and it was really suffering. Why? Because it was being showed pictures that it didn't like. Or do you ever hear someone saying, well, I saw this dog and I could tell that it was really suffering. Why? Because it was made to listen to songs and I was listening to sounds that it didn't like. No. The pain that an animal experiences, whether that's a human or a four-legged animal, is if it's real pain, if it's real discomfort, if it's real unpleasurable sensations, then it's those that are received through the body. If it's good if you can understand that, but so I mean, what is the point? What are we trying to actually establish here? What we're trying to establish here is the fact that everything else, all the other sensations that we in our own minds determined to be pleasurable or unpleasurable, so these are the sights, the sounds, the smells, and the tastes, are products of our own imagination. They are products of our own minds. It's our minds that determine whether a sight is pleasurable or not, whether a sound is pleasurable or not, whether a taste or a smell is pleasurable or not. And yet, you know, again, please feel free to ask the question, so what? Well, the point is, to give your eyes pleasure, or to give your mind pleasure through your eyes, to give your mind pleasure through your ears, to give your mind pleasure through your nose, to give your mind pleasure through your tongue, think for a moment about how far you've gone. How much pain did you inflict on yourself? How hard did you work? How many hours did you labor? How many hours did you sit down on a plane with your backside on one seat, on a seat, not able to turn left or right, so you could go and look at all these pictures. How many hours have you traveled on a, just, you know, forget a plane, in a car, when you go on holiday, you know, when you go driving, you know, say you want to go to the beach, and the beach is what, 50, 60, 70 kilometers away. Well, you've got to put your backside on this, on a car seat, and then you've got to travel there. Have you never felt the pain on your backsides? Sat on a chair or for a few hours? What about when you're at the movies? In the cinema? You've got your eyes wide open. You're looking at this, at some pictures on a screen. You're listening to the sounds that are coming from the speakers. What about your body? Sometimes you're feeling, you know, what about, you know, you're watching a movie and you don't want to get up. Your mother says, hey, come eat. And, you know, you're starving right now, but you're not prepared to get up, are you? You're hungry, but you're not prepared to get up. Why? Because your eyes want to see these pictures. Your eyes and ears, they wants to enjoy, wants to take pleasure from the things you're seeing and hearing on the television, when ultimately all that is but a dream. Why do you do this to yourself? Why do you do this to yourself? Are you trying to be happy? Do you not want to be happy? Then why pursue happiness in a dream? What about the life that I live then, as a monk, having now renunciated, now trying to cure my madness? I mean, isn't a life where you're prepared to sacrifice physical comfort to gain pleasure that is nothing but a dream, isn't that the life of a lunatic? Isn't that the life of a madman? Isn't that the life of a crazy person? Well, when I understood that, that's what I wanted to cure, I realized I'm mad. I realized I was a lunatic. I realized I was a crazy person. And that's what I'm trying to cure now. That's what I'm trying to treat now. So think about it. You might be, you know, living a comfortable lay life right now. You know, you might have a 60-inch, 70-inch, I don't know how big television screens are these days. Okay, you might have yourself a PS4. You might have yourself a hi-fi audio system and the latest computers and the latest gadgets. I mean, forget for a moment that because of all of these things you have to endure dukkha dukkha sankhara dukkha nipannama dukkha. I mean, put that all to a side. Even if you forgot all of that for a moment. Do you not realize that the reason you're using all these devices, the reason you're bringing all these things home and you're keeping all these things with you, is so that you can please your eyes, you can please your ears? Why do you go to restaurants? Why do you go on holiday? Why do you go on safaris? To live a dream. Am I not right? Aren't you trying to live a dream? Do you not live a dream? Are you not living a dream? I mean, if you think about it, really, how many hours do you sleep in a day? You think you sleep for 6 hours? You think you sleep for how many hours, right? Some people sleep for 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours. I would argue that you're actually sleeping 24 hours a day. You're all sleeping 24 hours a day, just like I was sleeping 24 hours a day. How come? Because when I was sleeping, when I was actually sleeping on my bed, I was dreaming. And when I was awake, all the things that I was doing, trying to please my eyes and my ears and my nose and my tongue, I was dreaming. Why? Because all those things I took in were nothing but Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana, and it lasted one flash. It lasted one moment and then disappeared, never to come back again. All that was left was a memory. When you wake up from your dreams, all that's left is a memory of the dream that you had. Can you see that dream again? Never. Can you live that dream again? Never. Why? Because it's just a memory. Well, what about the life that you live? What about the hours that you stay awake after you've woken up from sleep? Isn't that a dream? Well, then if so, how many hours do you sleep a day? When someone asks you again, how many hours do you sleep a day? Shouldn't your answer be, well, actually, thinking about it, I sleep all day. This is why I realize that this precious life that I've got, I can't be spending sleeping all day. When my physical body wants sleep, it's for real. Because the body needs sleep, because the body needs to repair itself, because the body needs to excrete the things that it doesn't need, the waste that it doesn't need, all of that, you know, all of that biochemical processes that happen inside the body. It does all of that and it repairs itself and rejuvenates itself while I'm asleep. So fair enough, it needs a certain amount of sleep. And that's the body telling you that it needs sleep. No question. We're not questioning any of that. Physical pain, physical pleasure is for real. But everything else. You know, you'll know that the Buddha, he talks about the four requisites. The four things that a monk needs. What are the four things a monk needs? A monk needs food. A monk needs shelter. A monk needs clothing, as in a robe. And a monk needs medicines to cure illness, disease, etc. All these four things are to cure what? The eye? Is it the ear? Is it the nose? Is it the tongue? No. It's to satisfy physical discomfort. Why? Because physical discomfort is what's real. Well, what about all the other discomforts? What about the sights that make me unhappy? What about the sounds that make me unhappy? What about the tastes and the smells that make me unhappy? Well, the Buddha, in his infinite compassion, gave me something to cure those frustrations and pains as well. What was that? The Dhamma. He gave us the Dhamma. He said, these four requisites are to cure real pains and real illnesses. And the Dhamma, that's to cure your madness. You're a lunatic. You're a crazy person. You're a mad person, he told me. Here's the Dhamma. Now go treat yourself. These four things are for physical, real pain. You're allowed to use these. Think about this. Ask yourselves, why do you inflict pain on yourselves? Why do you suffer so much to live a dream? You know, I imagine that most of our listeners are young folk from around the world. You know, probably young children between the ages of, I would assume, 6, 7, 8, 10 maybe, all the way up to, you know, middle ages and perhaps the elderly. So you can all relate to these experiences. You can all relate to what I'm talking about. This is why I go back to my past, you know, my life as a lay person. And the life I lived then, and I compare that to the life that I live now. And then try and show you how far I've come from there and how my life is different now to what life was back then. It's to help you understand that back then I was living a dream. It's to help you realize that the life that you're living is a dream. When you wake up from that dream, you'll have nothing left. Okay, think about this. Say you are a hard-working person, you've got a job, and the job pays you a good wage. Okay, so let's say, for instance, you are a, I'll keep it really simple. Let's say you're a construction worker, you're a builder, okay, and you're paid by the hour, you're paid $100 or £100 for every hour that you work. Now, if you work 10 hours in the real life, you get £1,000. How many hours do you need to work in your dream world to earn the same money? To earn the same amount of money? How many hours? In the dream world? 10 hours? 12? 50? 100 hours? Are you ever going to earn that money? No matter how many hours you build in your dream world, you're not going to earn anything. Why? Because it's a dream. This is why the happiness that you're trying to seek in your lives, if it's all but a dream, then you're never going to be happy by doing that. You're never going to achieve true happiness by doing that. This is why I'm making a plea to you. Open your eyes. Wake up from your dreams. Realize that you're living a dream. Realize that the happiness that you're trying to pursue, the happiness that you're trying to reach, is one that you're trying to do in your dreams. The sights you're trying to see that you think is going to give you happiness is nothing but a dream. It was just a flash that gave you Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana, and that was it. It was gone. To continue to get Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana, what you have to do is to keep looking at that object. And yet ultimately, it doesn't matter whether you look at a picture that you like or you look at a picture that you don't like. What your mind's doing is purely Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. Even if that Vedana was a Sukha Vedana, which is a good feeling, a good sensation, that only lasted one flash of a moment. What about the next moment? It's gone. I mean, think about this. So, you know, let's take the example where there are two pictures. One is a picture of feces and the other is a picture that you really like, okay? It's a flower that you really like, okay? How much, you know, if you were forced to look at the picture of feces for an hour, how long do you have to keep looking at the picture of the flower before you feel that you no longer have the displeasure, before, you know, you're looking at the picture of the feces and that's a painful sensation. Why? Because the mind has, you know, the mind has a view, the mind has a notion that looking at feces is, I don't like that's painful, okay? How long, if you've been staring at that picture for 1 hour, how long then do you have to keep looking at the picture of the flower before you feel that, okay, I'm all right now? You know, that pain has now gone. I no longer feel the pain of looking at the picture of the feces. Well, of course, you realize that you only saw that picture of whatever you chase you didn't like for as long as the picture was in front of you. Your eyes were open and your mind was sending signals from your eyes to your brain, perceiving that you're looking at this picture. The moment that photo or that picture was taken away, or you closed your eyes, or someone came and knocked the daylights out of you and therefore your mind's gone into a coma, then you're no longer seeing that picture. And therefore, therefore you can come to the conclusion that, you know, all my mind was doing was taking in Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. When I was looking at that picture of the feces, it was producing what? Dukkha Vedana, as in painful Vedana. Painful sensations. When I was looking at the picture of the rose, then that was, or the flower, that was giving me Sukha Vedana, or pleasurable sensations. The two don't go into an equation. I can't give my mind more of one to take away the pain of the other. Or I can't take in more of the pleasurable so that the pain of having looked at the picture that I didn't like goes away. That doesn't work like that. The reason it doesn't work like that is because when you were looking at the picture of the feces of the picture you didn't like, it was nothing but a flash. It didn't leave anything. There was nothing left over. And yet, our lives we dedicate to look at pictures. Our lives we dedicate to listen to sounds. Our lives we dedicate to take in smells and tastes that we like. Ultimately, the mind is only interested in Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, which lasts for one flash of a second, and then it's gone. Isn't this life but a dream? Do you want to live a dream? Think about it. Reflect on this. You know, don't let these sermons be just a thing that you do on a Sunday. I mean, there are plenty of things you could do on a Sunday. Okay, I don't know what time this is in wherever you are. Perhaps it's a Saturday for some of you, or perhaps it's a Monday for some of you. But I'd expect most of you it will probably still be a Sunday. Okay? Don't let listening to this sermon just be one other thing that you do on a Sunday. In addition to waking up, cooking yourself a meal, going out playing with your friends, watching a movie, listening to a song, listening to a sermon. You know, don't let that just be one more thing that you do. Because the Dhamma that you get from these sermons should help you find true happiness. Because all the other things you're doing from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed are things that you think are making you happy. But it's a world that you've created in your own minds and you keep pursuing that. And what I'm trying to help convince, what I'm trying to show you is that these things you're doing are not really making you happy. And you're working so hard. You're investing your time, precious time, time that you're never going to get back. Every moment of life that passes away, you're never going to get back. Doesn't matter what age you are. Doesn't matter how healthy you are. Whether you're young or old, whether you're black or white. Every moment of life that passes away is a precious moment of life that is never, ever going to come back. And yet, you're freely, you're readily throwing away these precious moments, living a dream. Should we not take a moment to understand what is it that we're doing? Shouldn't these sermons really be your salvation? Shouldn't the Dhamma, not talking about me, forget this voice, it really doesn't matter. Doesn't matter where you get this Dhamma from. If you are able to take this Dhamma from another monk, from another lay person, from another sermon that you listen on TV or radio or on the internet, by all means, please, go and take it. You don't have to keep coming back here. All I'm trying to do is find happiness in my life. I've found that happiness. And every day I'm feeling happier and happier and happier. Why? The more I'm letting go, the more happy I am. But when I think about you all, I know clearly I can't see you guys. But I know that there are people listening to this. I know that there are people that exchange messages with us and they ask for these sermons. You know, the reason you're asking for these sermons is because you're still looking for happiness. You're still looking for that thing that you've always been looking for in life. By doing all these things you have been doing so far, you've not found it. This is why you're still looking for sermons. You're still looking for the Buddha Dhamma. So it's my duty to give you that, because I was there once. I was like you. I chased happiness. I went and did all these things that people do to find happiness. I invested money, I invested in gold, I invested in bitcoins, and I went to Toastmasters, I did this, that and the other, I made money, I bought cars, I got married, I bought houses and properties and everything you can imagine. All the things that you either have done or you're preparing to do, I've done. I did it. And realize none of those things were real life. None of those things were the things that were making me happy. I realize today that that was all but a dream. Where are all those movies that I went to watch? I mean, I've told you, I've been very honest and very candid with you in the past, as I will continue to be. I really enjoyed watching movies. I really enjoyed classical music. In fact, there was a time where I used to be a singer. In popular media, I used to sing. But today, all of that is a dream. Now, don't you all just go start Googling. That was a dream. I'm telling you, that's a life that I threw away, that I spat away, like the saliva in your mouth when you wake up in the morning, you go and wash your mouth. You throw it away, you discard it, you know, and you don't look back and you don't even think to look back at it. What's gone is gone. And good riddance is what you say when you do that. That's the kind of life that I discarded. That's the kind of life that I put away because I realize the life that I live today is what is making me happy. Because it's the happiness in letting go. There'll probably be young people among you. Young teenagers and strong people who've got a long life still left. Provided, you know, you're able to live that long. And, you know, provided you don't come across an accident or something that takes away your life unexpectedly. So if you have that luxury and all these moments that you live, whether it be a dream or awake, and obviously, you know, we've just established that 24/7 you're living a dream. 24/7, 365 days a year you're living a dream. If you're listening to these sermons, then perhaps the time that you spend, the 1 hour, the 2 hours that you spend listening to these sermons are maybe the only time that you're not living a dream. So the rest of the week you're living a dream. You know, when you listen to these sermons, I don't tell you to go and enjoy in sensual pleasures. Why? Because that's a dream. That's what you've been doing all week. I ask you to wake up. I tell you to open your eyes and look. I tell you to go and look in a mirror, not look through the window. I tell you to point your finger at the person in the mirror, not at the person in the window. And I ask you to have a conversation with that person. I ask you to have an honest and open conversation with that person. So perhaps the only time that you're awake is this time that you listen to these sermons. So please don't make this hour, this 2 hours, just another thing that you do on a Sunday. This is why, in fact, today when I had the opportunity to go and take part in another program, and I posted a message on Skype earlier on to say that things were not quite going to schedule. There's another sermon that's going on, and I made reference to that at the beginning of this sermon. I decided I'm not going to stay there. I'm not going to listen to that sermon. I'm going to come and talk to you. I made that decision. I decided, I'll listen to a recording of that sermon. I'll not sit down and listen to that sermon face to face with Guru Hamdru. And I came to do this sermon in another room at the BMICH because I wanted to give you this time. I wanted to give this Dhamma to you. I wanted to gift my time to you. Because I realized that most of the week, you're all asleep. This is probably the only time you're going to be awake. And you know in what sense I mean this. So, think about this. Think about what it is that you're doing with your lives. This is precious life. Life that you're never going to get back. You're not going to get a second chance with this. If you don't use this as you should, if you don't make the most of this life, you're not going to get a second chance. The Buddha says, Dullabancha manusattena. Buddhotpada dullabang. Dullabang kana sampatti. Saddhammo paramadullabo. What does he mean? To be born human is rare, he says. He says it's very rare to be born human. He says it's very rare to be born in the era of a Sammasambuddha. The birth of a Sammasambuddha is very rare. And to be born in an era where the Sammasambuddha is alive, his Dhamma is alive, is very rare. And then he says, what's most rare, what's extremely rare, is the Dhamma itself. Saddhammo paramadullabo. Tell me, do you not have all of these things? Do you not have all of these things? Have you not been born human? Do you not feel fortunate? Do you not feel that what you have today, this human birth, is priceless? Do you not have the Buddha's Dhamma? Have you not been born in an era of the Gautama Sammasambuddha? Do you not realize how lucky you are? Do you not realize how fortunate you are? Have you not received the Dhamma? Do you not receive the association of a Kalyanamitra, a noble person, a noble friend? Yes, perhaps you don't get to meet Kalyanamitras face to face, but at least you get to listen to them, whether it's on the television or the radio or the internet, whatever channel. You know, back a few years ago or a few months ago, this Dhamma was not available in other languages other than Sinhala. But today there are not just ourselves but other monks who preach in English. And Dhamma that helps you attain Nibbana is available online and on popular media. Do you not realize how lucky you are? If you've been so fortunate, how precious do you think every moment of your life is? Why do you think a consultant doctor gets paid more than a standard doctor that's just passed with an MBBS? A consultant specialist doctor gets paid more because they're rarer. Why do you think gold is more expensive than iron? It's because gold is rarer. Why do you think diamonds are most expensive? Well, because diamonds are most rare. So, if the Buddha says, Saddhammo paramadullabo, if he says, manussattena dullabam, being born human is rare, if he says, the birth of a Sammasambuddha is rare, if he says, kana sampatti dullabam, or dullabancha kana sampatti, to be born in the era of a Gautama Sammasambuddha is rare, and if he says, Saddhammo paramadullabo, the Dhamma, that which helps you attain Nibbana, is extremely rare. To have received all four of these things, how precious do you think your life is? Think about this, please. All of you, listen to this sermon. I hope you begin to realize, if you haven't done already, the value of what you have, the precious moments of life that you have that you can dedicate towards enlightening yourself, the precious moments of life that you have that you can use to rid yourself of the causes that have been taking you to the hells for all this time in samsara. Remember, the Buddha says that the hells is where most animals, 99.999% of animals, spend the most time in samsara, is in the four hells. And today you've been born human. You've got a chance. You really have the chance. This most unique and most precious opportunity. Your life is precious. Your life is priceless. Think about it. Think about what you want to do with this life. Don't just live a life. Don't just live someone else's agenda. As I said at the beginning, the world is not trying to make you happy. You think it's trying to make you happy, it's a delusion that they put into your head. It's a fake. The reason they do that is because, well, for as long as you're unhappy, for as long as you remain unsatisfied, disappointed and frustrated with your lives, guess what the world can do? Make money off of you. Restaurants are open today because you're not happy just eating whatever you can find at home. Entertainment attractions are open today because you're not happy just sitting at home with your eyes closed. You want to go and see movies, listen, go to a musical concert, go to a play center, right? This is why the world's operating. This is why the world's running. For as long as you're unhappy, the world's going to be happy. So for you to think that I can go to the world and expect the world to make me happy, don't you think something's wrong there? Because if you were happy, if you were really happy, the world would have to shut down. You know, think about the funeral directors. Okay? I know this might sound like a crude example, and there may be some of you who either run funeral directors or perhaps someone who's a relation of yours. But this is the truth. We can only talk the truth. You know, when I started this sermon, I said, Namo tassa bhagavato samma sambuddhassa. Having paid homage to the Buddha, I can only speak the truth. I can't say things to make you happy if that's not ultimate happiness. How do you think a funeral director can be happy? Is a funeral director happy when everyone in the world is happy? Is a funeral director happy when everyone in your family is happy? Or is a funeral director happy when everyone in your family is unhappy? Why? Because you've just lost your most loved family member. So if that's how they make their money, when people die, then is the world any different? Doesn't the world make money off of your suffering? Isn't the whole world full of funeral directors? Isn't this a world full of funeral directors? Think about this. Think about all of the things we've been talking about today. Ultimately, no one comes to your salvation. It's not the money that you've earned that's going to come and save you or liberate you. It's not the number of properties you have or the cars you have. It's not how much money you have in your bank account that's going to come and save you. That's not what's going to give you the salvation that you're looking for. The only salvation you have, the only refuge you have, is the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. It's not me. It's the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. That is why when we worship the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, we say, Natti me saranang anyam, Buddho me saranang varang. There is no one else that can be my refuge. There is no one else that can be my refuge other than the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. We've talked about what the meaning of the word saranang is. In fact, I think the sermon is on YouTube, so I would encourage you to go and listen to it if you haven't already. Saranang is, we use the word loosely, refuge, but it means it has such a much deeper meaning, a much more profound meaning. This is the only way we can free ourselves from the shackles of samsara. So, let us all strive to do that. In this opportunity that we have, where we've all been born human, where we all have been born in the time of the Buddha. Remember, this is a Buddhottpada Kale, as in, This is an era where a Buddha is born and where his Dhamma prevails. The Buddha claimed that his Dhamma will last 5,000 years. So if a Buddha has claimed that his Dhamma will last 5,000 years, it's not going to last 4,999 years, and it's not going to last a day after 5,000 years. His word is final. We have already consumed 2,650 of those years. This is the last chance we have. It's the last lot that we have left. Remember, diamonds were precious because they're rare. When we had 5,000 years left, every year was precious. But now you have only 2,650 years left. Oh, sorry, you only have 2,350 years left. How much more rare do you think every year is? How much more rare do you think every month is? How much more rare and precious do you think every day is? Every hour, every minute, every second. Do you want to spend that time sleeping? Do you want to spend that time dreaming? Or is it time to wake up? Is it time to open your eyes? Understand that the happiness you're looking for in this world is all but a dream, and then do something about it. It's time to act. If you don't do it now, you will lose this human birth, you will lose the time of the Buddha's era, and you will lose the Dhamma. And when that happens, nothing, no one will come to save you. Don't wait for that day to come. Act today. Okay. So, I hope that you have learned and taken something from today's sermon. We do invest a lot of energy in delivering these sermons. And as I said, while I had the opportunity to go and listen to another sermon, in fact, I explained this last week, I think. I like listening to sermons more than preaching, because I realize that I still have delusion and ignorance and attachment and desire and aversion in me. If I still have raga, dvesha, moha, you know, I'm still going to keep coming back into samsara. That is my number one priority, to stop that senseless, meaningless, essenceless process. So if that's my number one priority, any time I spend away or not doing that is time that I have to be very careful of. And it's that time that I always think twice about, that I decided today to come and spend delivering this sermon to you. We do invest a lot of energy, not just myself, but everyone that makes these sermons possible. That includes you as well. All of you that tell your friends about this, that share these sermons with others, that help with transliterating these sermons into readable format. Because, you know, remember, there are lots of people who don't have access to the internet. Even in today's world, I mean, you may be living in countries where the internet is, you know, it's like a bread knife. Yeah, you can find it in every house, every home. You don't think twice about it. You expect that to be you take it for granted. But there are still people who don't have access to the internet. And for them, sometimes, you know, they don't have access to a computer or a device on which they can listen to something. So to be able to provide this in print media, at least, is going to be extremely helpful. And I know there are people who are working to do that. But, you know, these sermons, we do one every Sunday. And, you know, if you spend 2 hours, 2.5 hours delivering one of these sermons, then that's a lot of effort to transliterate this into a document. So there's always demand for more people. And if you're interested, then, you know, please do get involved. Because the merits that you will acquire in doing so, I can't tell you, it's this much. It's infinite, the amount of merits that you can acquire from doing that. If just one person reads, not the whole document, half a document, one page, half a page, And if they understand, if they at least begin to understand that this world is anicca, dukkha, anatta, how much merit do you think you'll gain from that? There was once when a man goes to a Buddha and asks him, "Venerable sir, how much merit can someone gain by offering alms?" He says, and the Buddha replies, "If you offer alms to a lay person or a worldly mundane person, that is not at all virtuous. That is 100 times better than offering food to a dog or an animal. If you offer the same alms or the same food to someone who is virtuous, but this is not someone who is an Arya. Remember, this is a non-Arya. Someone that is virtuous, a virtuous human being, that is 1,000 times better. It requires 1,000 times more merit than offering the same food to someone who is non-virtuous. And then if you offer that food to someone that is on the sotapanna marga, that is the path to becoming sotapanna, that is 1,000,000 times greater in merit. 1,000,000 times greater in merit than offering it the same thing to someone that is a virtuous person. And then if you offer the same food to someone that is a sotapanna, then that is 1,000,000 times more merit than offering it to someone that is on the path to becoming a sotapanna. So you get the idea. And he continues that. And he says, ultimately, if you offer food to someone that is an arahant, then that is 1,000,000 times more meritorious than offering that to someone who is on the path to become an arahant. And then he says, if you offer food to a paccheka Buddha, that is 1,000,000 times more meritorious than offering that food to an arahant. If you offer that food to a sammasambuddha, that is 1,000,000 times more meritorious than offering the same food to a paccheka Buddha. And then he says, this is the best bit. This is the bit I love. He says, if you offer the same food to the Mahasangha, so not thinking about one person, you know, not offering the food to a Sammasambuddha, but actually offering it to the Mahasangha, which of course includes the Sammasambuddha, and it includes all the monks and the bhikshus and bhikshunis, and the upasakas and upasikas, it includes all of them. If you bear all of them in mind and offer a meal or anything really, that is part of the four requisites to the Mahasangha, then that is 1,000,000 times more meritorious than offering it to a Sammasambuddha. And then he says, if you practice Arya Maitreya, that is noble compassion, for the time it takes for someone to sniff a flower, that is 1,000,000 times more meritorious than offering alms to the Mahasangha. And then finally he says, if you practice anicca, dukkha, anatta for one flash of a second, one split second, the time it takes for a lightning bolt to hit the earth, if you practice anicca, dukkha, anatta for just one tiny moment, the merit that you acquire is 1,000,000 times more than practicing noble compassion. And then he stops there. So, is there anything that is more meritorious than practicing anicca dukkha anatta? How can one practice anicca dukkha anatta with no understanding of what that is? And therefore, if you help someone, if you enable someone to do that, if you contribute in some way, shape or form to help someone learn about anicca dukkha anatta and practice anicca dukkha anatta, are you not contributing to that meritorious deed? Don't you feel that you're going to benefit from that as well? How much merit do you think you're going to acquire from that? Because you help them to practice the most meritorious deed ever. You know, people help other people go offer alms at the temple. I'm sure you'll all have done that at some point. you go to the temple, you know, it's your friend that's offering the alms, or your brother, your sister, or another family, and you go with them and you help them. You pray, help prepare food, or sometimes you just help serve the dishes. You serve food, or sometimes you just help with washing up, or just, you know, perhaps sweeping the temple at the end of the process. Because you understand and you know that that's going to acquire merits. Well, that is offering food to the Mahasangha. What about if you help someone to practice Anicca-dukkha-anatta? In the Buddha's words, he says, this is the most meritorious thing that anyone can ever do. So this is why we say, do whatever you can to spread this Dhamma, to disseminate this Dhamma. If you understand this Dhamma, then please speak to other people. Talk and preach what you know. Don't talk about what you don't know. Don't talk about what you don't understand fully. But talk about what you know. Preach what you know. Help other people understand what you know. And then they might ask you questions and then you'll think, actually, I don't quite understand this. Then, excellent, great. Because you've just realized that there are gaps in your understanding. So what do you do then? You go and then talk to someone. You go and speak with someone that can help you uncover that. You can go and speak to a monk at your temple. Or you can forward a question to us and we can pick those things up. All of these things will help you attain Nibbana. So don't let go of those opportunities easily. Make the most of it. Why? Because Saddhammo Parama Dullabo. Buddhotpada Dullabo Dullabo Kana Sampatti. Manusattena Dullabang. You've got all four of those. Make the most of it. And make a firm determination to attain at least the Sotapanna Phale in this birth itself. So, let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired in delivering this sermon and in listening to this sermon to all those beings that we invited at the start of this sermon, to all the Devas, the Brahmas, the spirits, the demons and the dead, all our past and distant relations, as well as any of our family that's alive today who may rejoice in this meritorious deed. May they all rejoice in these merits, may they all accept these merits, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. May all those people that helped us organize this event, who worked tirelessly and relentlessly to get the technology to work, as well as share this Dhamma throughout the world using technology, using visual media, using audio media, as well as using print media, and in any way, shape or form, may they all be able to receive these merits, may they all rejoice in these merits, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. And finally, may all of us, you and I, who we've all gathered today, all of us who've gathered today to listen to this sermon, may the merits we have all acquired in the process of delivering this sermon, in the process of listening to this sermon, and throughout the last 2.5 hours, having listened to the Lord Buddha's Dhamma, having taken the time out of our busy lives to try and open our eyes to realize that this is a dream that we've been living. May the merits that we have all acquired help us all open our eyes. May it help us all live, wake us from the dream, and help us all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. May you all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana in this birth itself. Theruvan Sarnai.